Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Liza Rodman's early years were chaotic, to say the least. Her early summers in the 1960s were spent on Cape Cod in Provincetown, where her mother Betty worked cleaning motels during the day and partying in Provincetown's bars by night. She was left alone an awful lot, and her babysitter was often a gentle, quiet handyman who would keep her company during the day. She and her sister would accompany him on his various errands, including running to dumps on the Cape, including a secret garden in Truro. Now, fast forward several decades, Liza, who's been suffering from nightmares, finally sees a face in one of her dreams, and it's the face of her babysitter handyman, Tony Costa. She tells her mother, and her mother's response was, well, he was a serial killer. In fact, Tony Costa was responsible for 5 brutal deaths buried in that same secret garden in Truro. Rodman was haunted and obsessed in reconciling this kind-hearted adult in her rudderless childhood with the cold-hearted killer Costa seemed to be. It launched a multi-year investigation into her childhood memories and a search on how Tony Costa, by all accounts a bright boy and intelligent man, became a murderer. Working with longtime friend and investigative journalist and news anchor Jennifer Jordan, they fleshed out Liza's memories and Tony Costa's backstory in the book The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. In the course of the book, they closed 3 cold cases of women suspected of being killed at Costa's hands who actually survived their acquaintance with him. Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan are my guests today. Liza and Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
The opening chapter of The Babysitter is a doozy. In just a couple of pages, you lay out what journey we're going to take, and it also gives us a very quick taste of the family dynamics that allowed a person like Tony Costa in your life, Liza, at a young age. Tell us the story of how you discovered the truth about Tony Costa, this boy that once babysat you and your sister.
I discovered what was happening as I had gone back to school in my early 40s to finish my bachelor's degree, and I started having these horrific nightmares, and I did what I usually do because they alarmed me, so I started writing them down. And when I did that, I started noticing the similarities between them, the images that were all similar. I was always being hunted. Someone was always holding a weapon to my head. It was just really frightening. So I started writing them down, and eventually, as they went on, I woke up one night in the middle of the night, and I had Tony Costa's face in my dream, who I recognized. And so I said, well, it was so alarming that I said, I need to find out what's going on. So I gathered my aunt and my mother, and my aunt is my mother's best friend, but we always called her auntie. And she was the one who brought us to Provincetown to begin with. So I gathered them up for dinner, and I said, you know, I'm having these nightmares. And there's Tony Costa in my dream. What is he doing there? Why is he there? Is there something you're not telling me? And that's when my mother turned to me and said, well, I know he became a serial killer. I know.
And then, of course, you said, a serial killer.
I did. I was stunned. I mean, it was one of those moments where everything slows down and, you know, I was very taken aback. And I said, the Tony, we know the Tony, our gentle Tony. And that's basically how it went. And then she said, well, you know, what's your problem? You know, he didn't kill you, did he?
Well, I love that last line because it gives us a very clear sense of your family dynamics growing up.
Yes, it does.
Now, Jennifer, when Liza related this story to you, what was your reaction?
My reaction was, boy, that sounds like a bestseller to me. I had already written a couple of books, three books, and was in between projects. And I had heard this story from Liza, as she said, in around 2005. And I kept asking her in the ensuing years, how's The Babysitter coming? That's a great project. Oh, my God, what a book it would be. And she would, you know, fingers to the ears, la, 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 I can't talk about it. It's too difficult. I don't know where to begin. I don't know how to process this. And so at one point when I was between projects, I said to her, well, let's work on this together because I have a structure in mind that will work. And, you know, you've done all this incredible research. So let's collaborate.
Now, what the book does is it does reclaim Liza's memories of this time but it also investigates Tony Costa's life as well. Was that a distribution of labor there where one person is basically, you know, Liza is sort of writing a memoir and you're doing an investigative crime procedural?
Well, it was more collaborative than that. Liza had done almost 15 years worth of incredible research already on Tony, on the case, on the trial, on the crimes, his victims, as well as drafting her memoir. So when I came into it, I was kind of handed literal boxes of data. And so I started organizing that into the chapter structure that you see in The Babysitter now with Tony, Liza, the voices going back and forth. You know, once the structure was set, Liza and I worked very cheek to jowl and almost word by word on honing and editing and really crafting it into the book you now see.
So, Liza, once you found out the truth about this handyman on Provincetown that basically your mother had handed you off to basically get you out from under her feet, as she would say, did you immediately begin wanting to know more about his life?
Oh, yeah. I dropped right into it. There was a moment in time where I thought, well, this might make more sense than I want it to make. And so I said, I've got to find out. Sort of became a personal excavation. I really didn't know where I was going to go with it. I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just knew I had to. It just drew me right in, and I thought, well, I've got to find out more about that time because I have had some memories. First of all, I have one of those memories that sort of records things in time pretty well, and I'd had some disturbing stuff but had no idea where it came from and knew that there had been murders, knew that there had been problems in Provincetown at that time, read a little bit of something in the paper here and there, but never made the actual connection. So when the connection was made on that day in 2005 over a bowl of soup, I said, I need to know. I think I need to know. And so I just started researching.
Now, was there much written about Tony Costa? As you write several times in the book, both of you, that his crimes took place at a time when we really didn't refer to people as serial murders yet. I mean, that was just starting to become a thing at this particular time. Was there much written about him as far as, you know, going back to his family life that you recount in The Babysitter?
We put together, well, there were, you know, he started with the police in 1961. So from there forward, there was a great deal written about him. Court records, police interviews, you know, but grade school records. I mean, we had everything because there had been a book written about the case itself in 1981 by a newspaper guy and also a writer, a nonfiction writer on the Cape. And so he wrote an exhaustive book about the case. Then there were newspaper clippings. I mean, it was a horrific crime at the time it was occurring. And so we had a lot of information from newspaper clippings and old headlines. And then we had interviews with people. So there were over 10,000 pages, if you include the trial transcript, which was 1,000 of those, that we had our hands on. So what we did is we recreated, and we were really interested, certainly interested in what had happened to Tony and how he became who he was. But in terms of the writing and the narrative, we narrowed it to those years, and we had plenty to draw from.
And we also had the exhaustive book that Liza referenced that was published in 81, really focused on the case, on the police, trial itself, so that we had all this information that had really never been explored, had never been processed in any real way. So that when we, if you'll pardon the expression, fleshed out Tony, we had information and we had documents that had really never been brought to the light of day.
And then Tony also had a manuscript, which he tried to publish himself from Walpole, which was just sort of the rantings of someone who was struggling.
Yeah, Walpole is the prison where he was held.
Yes, Walpole Prison in Massachusetts. And Tony's lawyer, just to go jump forward in time a little bit, Tony's lawyer during the case, he was going to get paid by publishing a book on Tony and Avis's life. That's how he was going to get paid.
Avis was his wife that...
At the time, yeah.
And he had married her when she was, what, 14?
Yeah.
And he was like 18 and the 14 or something like that? Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And so the lawyer, very quickly after Tony was arraigned, went to prison and got them both to sign off and sign away their rights to their own story. And so, you know, Tony was not only an exploiter, he was exploited. And then there was another piece written as the lawyer was trying to get paid and they were trying to write this book. He had several writers, one of them being Kurt Vonnegut, who he asked, can you write this? Can you make this look like something we could publish? And Vonnegut walked away over money, but then there were a series of other writers who tried to write the story. So we had so much information. We had police investigator notebooks. We had evidence from the trial as well that had no business being anywhere but in the archives at the Supreme Court of Massachusetts. But instead, it's strewn all over the country. So we had a ton of information.
Mm. Well, you know, your recounting of your episodes with Tony Costa strikes me as a reader as, you know, he seems like a somewhat creepy guy. You know, he's putting your hand on your upper thigh at points. But, you know, he doesn't do anything as far as I read. But but what probably gave him an air of normalcy was the fact that in your life at the time, there was a whole succession of creepy people in your mother's life.
Right. And also in mine, you know, if I can paint a quick picture for you, here's a kind of the very first luxury resort in Provincetown, right on the water. And there it's filled with young men and young women, teenagers really. And it's filled with the music of the time. And it's 1966 and Let It All Hang Out is your favorite expression. My mother's single. My mother's divorced. She has a string of boyfriends. And we had a string of babysitters, most of them much worse than Tony ever thought about being. And to be fair, Tony wasn't a traditional babysitter. He was just someone who would, they could get rid of us. They could say, will you take them? My aunt tells a great story about her standing at the front desk, looking down the long driveway and seeing him coming. And she'd yell out to the back, here comes Tony. And we'd all go running out to the back to beg to get in the truck.
Mm. And he would basically take you on his rounds as he was working as a handyman.
He was going to the dump. He was doing trash runs at the time. And in those days, you didn't have to have you weren't relegated to one dump. So we used to like to joke that we were at every dump up and down the Outer Cape at one point or another. And the proximity to the Truro dump, it's very close to where he buried those bodies. And also, it's where he kept his drugs. And it's where he hid equipment, you know, it's where he grew his marijuana. So it wasn't just one place to him. It was also an old lover's lane. So there was a lot going on, and the proximity to the dump was quite close. So I think that's how we ended up there. He was either, you know, taking a load of trash and then going to the woods and picking up some LSD or whatever he had out there. So I think that's how it happened.
You mentioned that at Provincetown at the time was just sort of a wide open summer town. It was a place to get away. It was a haven for gays at a time when that was illegal in most places and you would be likely to get rousted. So it was very much a countercultural community. How did that contribute to Costa being able to commit these crimes and get away with them for a while?
Yeah, I mean, Norman Mailer used to call the Outer Cape the Wild West of the East Coast. And it was a haven for outcasts and for gays looking for liberation and for hippies looking to crash and for everyone to do these new drugs that were coming on the market and just to, as Liza said, let it all hang out. And Tony was just one of those other stoners kind of stumbling along Commercial Street, you know, down the middle of Provincetown. And so when girls and young women started to disappear, and even though they were last seen with Tony Costa, nobody was connecting the dots because nobody was really paying attention. Mm. And so he was able to blend in with kind of the insanity of the times and the craziness and, you know, characters riding in their Speedo bathing suits up and down the street handing out gay literature. I mean, it's just, It was a time that nobody had seen before. And so Tony was able to conduct his nefarious activities pretty much in, you know, in wide open secrecy.
And that was a good spot for my mother, too, because to put her in context just a little bit, she was a single divorced Catholic in 1963. And that was, you know, you almost couldn't come to people's house for dinner. And she felt that. And she was pissed. So to go to Provincetown and find that place where everybody's just slightly different and everybody is accepted was like an elixir in a way for her. And I think for us, too, as we felt sort of accepted into the wider community.
Now, the book does spend some time trying to understand how Tony Costa got to the place he was when he was in your life, Liza. And you do spend quite a bit of time on his backstory. What can you share about what you learned that perhaps made him the person that he ended up being?
Well, first, and we're careful to say we're not neuroscientists, but we play them on podcasts. But the big thing we discovered is that these people, these types of personalities, are not born, they're made. And that all of them have some kind of trauma in their background. And that it doesn't always have to be a big thing that happens. If there are other things present, a brain abnormality, for instance, in conjunction with a genetic makeup, a certain genetic makeup, and bang, you know, you've got a problem. Because not all psychopaths and not all sociopaths commit murder. So the common denominator becomes, or one of the common denominators becomes this element of trauma. And it seems that Tony, what we knew about his young life was that there was one rape when he was about 12 years old. He was then quickly in trouble with the law. And, you know, we don't know who it was. We know who it was who committed the rape. We don't know their name, but we know that it happened. And we don't know about his mother. We don't know about his stepfather, who seemed to disappear. So there's a lot we don't know in leading up to, but what we do know is combine that trauma with whatever was going on in his brain and his genetics, combine that to all the signs were there for people. Mm-hmm. And you watch in the research, and this was a very interesting part of it, which is why we focused the way we did, was we watched him struggle with what was going on with him. He talked about it. He talked about it to friends. He didn't talk about it in a way they could hear, and he didn't talk about it in a way that, you know, made sense to anybody. I mean, no one even knew what a serial killer was. But people knew Tony struggled, and we knew from what he was reading at the time that he was trying to figure out his own brain. So, you know, you combine all of those things, and you get yourself to 1968, where his divorce is final. And, you know, potentially that was the final trigger. But he knew what was happening to him. And that, while it was alarming to us, it was also fascinating to watch him struggle.
Now,
to know that these things can be prevented now, if we do a little screening.
How many women did he actually murder? Because what your book also shows is that several women that it was thought that he murdered were actually very much alive.
Right. We know that he killed five. His own defense team suspected him of eight more. And of those eight, we discovered that three were not in his so-called kill docket. That the three that to this day, if you Google Tony Costa, these three women's names will come up as women that he killed, and we discovered that they were not, in fact, victims of him. But there are still five more possible, girls and women that went missing at that time that were never, quote-unquote, found. And mm-hmm. So we don't know the actual number of how many bodies Tony's responsible for. And how early he started, but we do know of the five whose bodies were recovered that, the first was in May of 68 and the last was in January of 69.
Now, three of those lost women you actually found in the course of your research. How did you go about finding them?
Well, unlike the investigators back in 1969, we had a breadth of search engines available to us and, you know, this thing called the internet. And so we were able to cross-reference with a list of search engines and online phone books and yearbooks and, you know, marriage records, divorce records. So I made a list of our three women and every possible name, you know, marriage name and daughter's name, and, you know, started calling and writing letters. And lo and behold, I got letters and calls back. And each of the families, the three women had all died since, but none of them at the hands of Tony Costa. And so I received word from the daughters and the sisters of these three women that, you know, they had very much survived him, and they were shocked to learn. You can imagine, here's your mother, here's your sister, and you've known her, you know, your whole life. Come to find out, you get a call from a journalist in Salt Lake telling you that, history records have it that your mother, your sister, was killed by a serial killer back on the Cape. And they were, you can imagine, flabbergasted. So it was a wonderful thing to kind of wrest those women from that dark history and to place them in the proper context of their lives, in the fact that they went on to marry and have children and, you know, lead lives outside of their interaction with this babysitter, Tony Costa.
My guests today are Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan, the co-authors of The Babysitter, which tells the story of Liza Rodman when she was a young girl and her summer with a babysitter that turned out to be a serial killer. Liza, can you talk a little bit about your memories and figuring out, you know, it's really hard to go back to our childhood and figure out exactly when things happened. What was that process like for you?
Yeah. It was exhaustive, actually, and exhausting. Because I had all kinds of stuff that I knew, but putting it in a narrative context is something else. Although, interestingly enough, now I think they've found their spot. I like to tell, in particular, about an interview that I heard with Paul McCartney recently, where he was asked what happens when he's driving along and there's a Beatles song comes on the radio. And he said, well, first I sing along, and second, I'm dropped right back into the studio laying down those tracks. And so a lot of what happened to me was matched up against music. Music plays a huge part in the book and a huge part in the memory of the time, my memory of the time. And so I used that, and I walked alongside of it. You know, I did multiple timelines, me and my Excel spreadsheets, and used to drive Jennifer crazy. But I had to map it out somehow, and I had to find a way to put these memories where they belonged. And I knew from the songs and researching when the songs came out what went where, too. Mm-hmm. So I used multiple ways in which I re-entered those memories to place them in time in an accurate way.
And, of course, your memory is also colored by the fact by what you now know about Tony Costa. How did you sort of, you know, you had to forget that to be able to accurately recall those memories? Don't you?
It's such an interesting question, and it is distinctly two narratives in my head, and I think it probably always will be. And it's another really good reason why this book had to be written by two writers, because I have gentle memories of Tony and Cecilia. So when I went up against what I knew to be true as an adult and what I was finding in these papers, it's truly two different people. And that's why we wrote the book the way that's why the book had to be written that way. I don't know if I'll ever make the leap of the person I knew, who was a little goofy, with the person who he became. I don't know if I'll ever bring those two together in time.
Not even the Tony who became, because he was actively murdering while he was taking Liza and her sister out for popsicles and putting him on the swing of Dairy Queen. Well, that's one of those realizations that was really horrific for both of us. We'd be like, oh, God, he was taking you out to the woods when those bodies were in the ground.
That's where the research began, to sort of brush his life up, what I was learning about his life, up against mine, and go, holy crap.
Yeah.
But as that co-author that is seeing a very different side of Tony Costa, how did you add to this narrative and help reconcile Liza's beliefs of, you know, this understanding of Tony, one side of Tony Costa, with the other?
Right. And not only the realization of Tony, but also the realization of Liza's mother. And and the trauma that Liza suffered at the hands of her mother. And it's, you know, it, at one point we realized that Liza was more afraid of her mother than of a serial killer. And that is a really troubling and painful memory to come to. So in the process of writing this book together, I often found myself in the role of helping, nudging, you know, cajoling, embracing Liza through some of this darkness and saying, you know, it has to go in the book. I mean, we can't sugarcoat your mother. We can't sugarcoat Tony. I know this was your memory of Cecilia, but something really dark happened there in his childhood, and who's in the childhood besides the mother. So I ended up many times, not all the time, but many times in the role of, you know, this has to be done this way. You know, we have to, as painful and as tough as it is, there is a reality, there's a truth that we know of in both Betty's story and in Tony's story that has to go on the page.
Right.
And Liza, to her credit, and Liza, to her, you know, courage, allowed that to happen. Allowed a lot of some really painful and ugly truths to be on the page.
Yeah, your mother, Betty, does not come off sympathetically at all in that book. And that, I know for a loving daughter, that must be a very difficult decision to make.
It is a difficult, it was, and it is. And however, a lot of those stories, you have to know my mother. And as I said before, you have to put her in context. And a lot of those stories were hers. Mm-hmm. She initially talked with me about the book and gave me certain filled in pieces. That was another way that I worked with my memory and hers, as did my aunt. And they've both passed away since. They both passed away before the piece was published. So I thought that was a little interesting. But she was, I'm giving you a moment in time, and that's how it felt to me. And I'm not necessarily, and that's what memoir is. And the importance of it, I think, and to Jen's point about getting that vulnerable on the page, is to make sure you get there so that other people can enter with you, and so that there becomes a universal thread where other people can say, geez, that happened to me, or geez, I have nightmares. And I can't tell you the number of times since the book has come out just, what, 3 short weeks ago, that I've heard that. People have mothers like that, you know, speaking of the mental illness piece of this. And my mother was a very non-empathetic person in all cases until the day she died.
The name of the book is The Babysitter. Liza and Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan are the co-authors of The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. It's published by Atria Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.